Hi, my name is Alonzo Ross, and I am acting as interviewer for John Curto, who has had a very colorful and productive chess career, and I've gotten involved because I've seen the amazingly high quality of chess that he's played over the years, as well as being a gentleman and a sportsman. So he's going to tell you about many aspects of his career. John. So, John, why don't you, do you want to...
Around 14 years of age. I think I started chess around 14 years of age, and magazines had, I don't even know what they'd call them, but you could sell products and get a premium. And the products I sold were, believe it or not, Christmas seals, which are a dime a dozen now, so to speak, and seeds, flower seeds, and vegetable seeds. And you'd sell them to your neighbors and friends. And so I was going to get a premium. And I wanted a hunting knife. And my parents thought that I'd end up cutting my fingers off, so they said, you've got to choose something else. I says, I don't like anything else. But they insisted, so I decided I would get a chess set. It was a small pig-in chess set, the kind with little cardboard drawers with the pieces were kept in, a board about, 4.5 inches square roughly. And I got it on the condition that my brothers, I had three brothers, one younger and two older, that they would learn chess with me. So I got the premium, and I went to the local branch library, and they had one chess book. It was a beginner's book by a fellow named Hoffer, I remember, H-O-F-F-E-R. And I remember looking in the back of the book, and I saw some printed games and descriptive notation. And it looked like algebra to me. But then again, I went back to the front of the book and read how the pieces move. And apparently the book was pretty good because by the time we got to the games, I started playing through them. And that sort of lit the fire. Of course, my brothers soon tired of playing with me at all. I don't think any of them ever played any chess after that. So I had a problem, and I went to the big library in downtown Lynn. Lynn had about 100,000 people at the time, so the library was pretty large. They had a half a dozen chess books, and they were in the adult section, so I needed special permission to go to the adult section. And two of the books that influenced me greatly were The Game of Chess by Tarish and My System by Nimzowitsch. And I went through the books over and over. And there was another one, The Golden Treasury of Chess, which is, I don't know how many games it had in it, but it was just mostly short games. I actually remember the author's name. I think he was a priest. His name was Wellmuth, Francis Wellmuth. Anyways, I went through those games quite a bit. So I needed more. It sounds a little archaic, but I called up the Lynn Chamber of Commerce and said, is there a chess club around? And he said, oh, yes, right in downtown Lynn. in the railroad station. I think it was on the second floor. So I went there, and I walked up to the second floor, and I opened the door, and there was a model train set up. With, you know, a little village and grass and trains and towns and all that sort of stuff. Wrong club. Next door was the chess club. And the windows in the chess club actually opened up onto the railroad tracks. I don't ever remember the trains bothering us at all. I don't know that. But one of the most interesting things that happened then was I found a chess magazine. It was Chess Review by Horowitz. So naturally, I stole it. A magazine all about chess? Nothing but chess? It's hard to realize how primitive things were in those days. There was no rating system. Chess clocks were hard to come by. Some of the clubs, we ended up playing in the local Metropolitan League. I guess it was the Boston Metropolitan League. And some chess clocks were electric, and you'd have to plug them in. And in those days, you didn't have an outlet on every wall. A lot of times, the tables had to be moved over to the outlet so you could plug in the clock. And the clock had no flag, and the hand would keep going a little bit even after you threw the toggle switch. So I ended up with a little plastic chess clock, which was like two pocket watches set into a plastic base with the on and off. You needed a clock. It seems to me I remember times where I actually had to play a league game without a clock because you didn't have them. People didn't have them. And of course, if a person gets in a lost position, they're not too much of a hurry to move anyways, you know. So I ended up playing first board for Lynn. And there was, again, next to no tournaments. There might have been around the country, but of course, couldn't travel at all. So I ended up winning the state title again. I tied with Dr. Katz, Gerald Katz. He had a very heavy German accent, but we ended up tying for first. So, but I should back up. The first tournament I won was in 1947. I won in the Massachusetts Schoolboy Championship. They didn't call them scholastics in those days. They were schoolboy championship. And I won that. And I have the games from that. And then of course, as I've already said, I won the state adult title in 48, tied for it in 49. I'm trying to remember whether I did it. I'd have to look it up, whether I won a New England title then. But at the end of 1949, I ended up going into the service. And I've read in the recent past where there was actually a recession in 1949. I mean, I don't think they called it a recession in those days, but there wasn't any jobs to be had. There was no fast food joints or anything like that. I couldn't get a job. In my family, you didn't stay home. You join the Army. My kid brother joined the Navy, and I had one of my older brothers was in the service during the Second World War. So I spent 3 years in the service. Luckily, I didn't end up in Korea, but the Korean War started while I was in the service. And my group was divided in half. We were engineers. I'd like to back up a little. When I went in, enlisted in the Army, I wanted to take up mechanical drafting. That's what I had in high school. I went to the Lynn Trade, and I learned what they call machine design. It's a fancy way of saying mechanical drafting. So I wanted to be a draftsman. And they said, we don't need draftsmen. Choose something else. It's like me with the chess set. I don't like anything else. You got to choose something else if you want to go in. So I chose to be an electrician. Sounded good. In 8 weeks, the Army taught me how to do everything from climbing telephone poles to wiring a house. When I came out, I didn't know a darn thing. So when they divided my group in half, half of them went to Okinawa. This was before the Korean War, just before it. And our group, luckily, went to England. And all the time I was in England, for 2 full years, I played 3 games of chess, serious games. I joined the Oxfordshire Chess Club. I met Leonard Barden at the time. I hope he's still alive. He wrote a column over there for a gazillion years. And he walked me around the Oxford University, and he introduced me to Dan Yanofsky, who ended up in Canada, I believe. And, well, Yanofsky is no longer with us either. But I played 3 games, of which I won 2 and lost 1. And the person I lost to was named Love, L-O-V-E, which brings me to my first marriage.
Well, before you do that, John, let me just ask a question.
Yeah.
It's clear you took to chess very quickly. What was it about chess that grabbed you? Why was it that you were, you said it was the only thing? Why was it that this you got so excited?
Well, first of all, I don't know what they call them in those days, but nowadays we probably call them a nerd. In other words, I wasn't athletic. Mm-hmm. I had nothing. So when chess came along and I found out, obviously, I was pretty good at it, I mean, it became the thing, the only thing I had. So I put all my time into it at that stage. And, of course, you know, the Army sort of jumbled things up a bit.
Sure.
But I could have done a lot of things then, but I resumed when I came out, even though I got married short. I came out in January 1953. It was demobbed, as one of these chess columns points out. And it took me a while to get going again. I ended up winning a number of tournaments in that period, say 54, 55, 56. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should back up too. The rating system came in when I was in the Army. It came in, I think, around 1950 or so. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they went through results they had and determined people's ratings. And I think my first rating was in the 2000 category. But even after winning a bunch of tournaments in the 50s, early 50s, I did not make master until 1959.
Well, let me just ask again. What was it about the chess? Was it that you discovered something you were really good at? Or I know in my own feeling, if when a combination works, it's a thing of beauty. Or when you have an idea and it works, and I just get all excited. What is it that drew you in?
It was the games I went through, you know, particularly the golden treasury of chess. You mm-hmm. know, they were short games, mm-hmm. and the brilliance of the games mm-hmm. was a real turn-on. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in time publishing 3 there were self-published three caviar books. Chess Review, well, first of all, Chess Life came out, I think, around the early 50s, too. It was just a newspaper of sorts. And Chess Review had a column of short games, and Horowitz called them the hors d'oeuvres of chess, caviars, chess caviars. So I took his, I gave him credit in my first caviar booklet. And the short games, basically, they were just beautiful, you know. And of course, my results in doing well at it, I mean, that certainly had input. But I actually have a certificate in here. Here's the picture that I was telling you about, was in the Chess Review that I wanted to show the guy in the flea market. Let's see. This is actually at the Lynn Chess Club. This kid was checker champion of New England. Look at me. I'm 16 years old. He was older than I was. Oh, that's just when I won the state championship. He wrote a lot of the earlier chess columns in the Globe.
I'm familiar with that name. I've heard of him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I played Arnold Denker. When we went to the Manhattan Chess Club, they were laying for us. I was on like sixth board or something like that, and I was playing a former champion. Where am I here? Oh, good. It'll come. Oh, here we are. I achieved the rank of U.S. rated master, 2242 points. And bear in mind, I probably already won the state championship four or five times and won the New England championship at least once. I would have to look up. I have no memory of that anymore. And it makes you wonder about the rating system.
Nothing's perfect in this world.
Well, they talk about inflation. I just don't know. I have something in here that where Mary Janian sent me a postcard saying my rating just popped over 2,500 at some point.
Wow, that's impressive.
But that was didn't stay there very long. But I stayed in the 2,400s for quite a period of time.
All right. So I interrupted you, but at one point you were about to say you mentioned an opponent named Love, and you were about to talk about getting married. So you want to go back to that? I don't want to disrupt your flow.
No. You mentioned an opponent there.
Love.
Oh, Love. Oh, okay.
and you said you wanted to segue to talking about your marriage, yeah. And I stopped you because I wanted to find out what drew you to chess.
So the person I got married to, I brought over from England. She was Scottish, and she was born in Glasgow. And so I brought her over, and we got married. Had a couple kids reasonably fast. And I played when I could, but basically I was just, you know, working full time. I would play on weekends.
And did you use your skills from the Army to continue as an electrician?
Well, it took me a while, I imagine, to gain strength. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I was still, you know, you might say I was still one of the better players in the area, actually.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remember when I bumped into Harold Ondas.
Yes, I know he was your longtime friend.
Oh, yes. And they held a testimonial for him at the Boston Globe offices. And I gave the keynote speech. My first recollection of Harold Ondas was when we were both going to a tournament at Brown University in Rhode Island. We were both lost on campus, and we both were looking at signs, and we bumped into each other. And to ensure that we wouldn't get lost in the future, we teamed up and started going to tournaments together. Invariably, I would drive him. Mm-hmm. But over the years, we played in countless tournaments. He took me to Bermuda a number of times. St. Martin's, one of my most memorable tournaments, once. Canada, once, a very memorable tournament. We traveled to the U.S. Senior Open. I forget what year it was, but I noticed one year that U.S. Senior Open was won by an expert, a fellow from, I don't know, the Midwest. And I says, boy, that looks pretty good if an expert can win it. So Harold and I went to, I think it was San Diego, and this was the Senior Open at the time. And who shows up but Larry Evans, the Larry Evans. I says, oh boy. Well, it turns out that he was towards the tail end of his career. We never even met in that particular tournament. I drew in the first round, almost lost, won the rest of my games. And Larry drew with a couple of 70-year-old people. So we ended up tying for first. And I know we went to at least two other senior opens, and one in Salt Lake City and one in Arkansas. And I think I either won those or tied for first. Who knows? But we played in venues all around the United States. And as far as my tournament records go, I was playing locally and I would win a very high percentage of tournaments. But once I started playing in U.S. Opens with Harold or the World Open, for instance, I'd get my head knocked off by grandmasters. So my records weren't quite as sterling. I don't know if you want to jump to another.
Well, let's see. Why don't you, since you've been talking about tournaments, why don't you talk a bit about the number of tournaments that you've won and which is the most memorable to you? Well, you're up to 934 wins, right?
936.
I apologize.
When I was with Harold, I would play sometimes in three or four tournaments a month. Mm-hmm. I used to talk about, I'd go to a tournament, sometimes by myself, and I'd put in an entry for next week's tournament. I'd mail it on the way to this particular tournament. As far as memorable tournaments go, the ones that I mentioned, the one in Canada and St. Martin's, were really memorable because I won a fair amount of cash. And the one in St. Martin's first. It was extremely strong, and I ended up losing to a Mexican fella named Zapata. God, I can't remember. My mind's going, because I had to knock off a pretty strong player who had just won the New York Open. And then going into the last round, I drew with John Fedorowicz, who was pretty decent at that time. And I ended up sharing one of the class prizes, which was quite substantial. A further memory on that is Harold had to go home. Our motel or whatever it was quite some distance away, so he took the bus home. I had to wait around to get my money. So I waited and waited and had a couple of drinky poos along the way, and they ended up paying in cash, $50 bills. It was very nice. So I had something like $3,500 in $50 bills.
Wow.
So then I had a problem of how to get home to the motel. So I put the money in my trousers and started walking. And the roads in St. Martin's are not built with sidewalks. The jungle was right up to the roads. So I was stumbling along the highway, and this car drove by, and screamed out that I was crazy. He used a little profanity, actually. He said, "You crazy, you stupid bugger." So I realized I was going the wrong way. I was heading away from town.
Oh, okay.
So I turned around and started coming back. And then I finally hit civilization. And there was a motel there. And I tried to wake somebody to drive me back. I was willing to pay I had a couple of bucks on me, you know. Mm-hmm. And I ended up still just walking the rest of the way home. And that was one of the more memorable of my tournament. In Canada, we played in North Bay, Ontario. And again, it was a top-heavy tournament. My mind's going around in circles now.
Well, no one expects you to remember 936 tournaments.
Well, if I concentrated just on that, I might be able to do it. But I'd like to mention some of the people that really helped me directly or indirectly. One of them was the organizer of the Log Cabin Chess Club.
Yes, you told me this story earlier about the man who took you to New Jersey. Why don't you tell us that story?
Okay. This fellow in New Jersey, he gathered as many strong players around as he could. He had a fellow from Pennsylvania. I think the fellow's name was Herman Hess, H-E-S-S-E. And he had the champion in New Jersey, and he had me, the champion of Massachusetts. So he didn't have grandmasters, but he had a pretty strong team. So he decided, besides playing in the New York Metropolitan League, he wanted to travel around the country by automobile. And the average working chess player wasn't free to take 2 or 3 weeks off in the summer. So I ended up playing first board on his first tour. And the first tour was was rather haphazard. It wasn't planned well in advance. We drove out to California, and we wouldn't have a match scheduled. He would call ahead and try and arrange a match. And so the matches were few and far between. And then we came back through Texas, Louisiana, and back up to New Jersey. But the second year, he was better organized.
And your parents agreed to just let you go on this trip with him?
Even though they didn't work? I was 17, you know, and there was a bunch of people on the trip.
Okay.
You know, it was, we did get in some sort of hairy situations, which I'll get into. The next year, there was decided to hold a match across the United States and Canadian border. In other words, some team from Minneapolis would play a team just over the border, and somebody in Washington State would play, and so on. We played in Montreal, and we played a match, and that was the beginning of this particular tour. And we came down through Detroit, Michigan. And somewhere along the line, we had two cars. And he had a real innovative idea so that the cars could keep track of one another. He had these little lights installed just, you might say, between the doors so that you could see the two little lights ahead of you when you were following the other car. Anyways, one of the cars broke down. So what do you do when you're in the Michigan area? You buy another one, which he did. So we headed straight down into Mexico. I've got the match here somewhere. We played in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, we went sightseeing. Some of the sites I can't tell you about, but we went up a volcanic mountain, and the mountain was named Popocatépetl. And if anyone is old enough, they remember a song from in the 1940s about Popocatépetl, Popocatépetl. It was a real snappy little ditty. Anyways, we drove up this mountain, parked the cars, and walked around. And then when we came back to the car and got in, the car started to slide into volcanic ash. So we had enough bodies to hoist the car back up onto the firm road and get out of there. We traveled further down and played one more match. I'd have to look up the specifics. It's all in here, by the way. And then we came back up through Louisiana and Washington, D.C. But the matches generally were arranged ahead of time. And we did pretty good, actually. So that was Euphoria Laux. I think he ended up dying at a chess tournament, which is the way to go. I think it was in Puerto Rico. But another fellow I'd like to mention who has since recently departed in the last year or two is Frank Berry from Oklahoma. He traveled around the country. He showed up in Massachusetts, California. I guess his family owned a bank in Oklahoma, and his twin brother, I think, is still down there. But Frank Berry was the real organizer, and he invited me out there for a tournament a few years back. And at the same time, he arranged a match between two of the strong players, two of the, how do we say it, the immigrant players. All of a sudden, I don't know if you remember, we used to call him Wojciechowicz. He has since passed.
I remember that name.
Yeah.
Did he pass? I didn't know.
Oh, he passed away quite a while ago, yeah. And the other guy was a Russian. Oh, God. He's still around. But anyways, that match was going on concurrently with the particular tournament. Anyways, Frank Berry not only brought me out there, he put me up. I ended up, winning a decent prize there too, which those are the good times. Okay.
Well, let me ask something that has always impressed me. During the time we've known each other at the Greater Worcester Chess Club, most of the time, you're clearly the strongest player in the club. And yet, I notice that you prepare for the games. You want to know whom you're playing, and you want to maybe have an opening innovation, even though you're already the strongest player. You never slack off. You always try to come in as strong as you can. How do you keep up that enthusiasm over so many years?
Well, I've just always done it. Mm-hmm. But the real problem with the Worcester Chess Club, and it's a big one for me, is the fact that I played you guys well over 100 times each.
Yes.
I'm talking about you, Mike, Donna's getting up there, Rem was another one. And as you age, it's very difficult to play a lot of different openings anymore. So that's why we tend to play a lot of the same stuff. It's very hard to vary. So that's what I'm always looking at. I go over our prior games that we play, particularly if I know which color and so on. And I've just always done that wherever possible, of course.
But many people will just get lazy with time, and you never do that.
You want to know the real big incentive? Money. I've always, it's rather a narrow way of thinking, but I always tried to work at chess where money was involved. I played for the Boylston Chess Club for a period of time. I forget which years these were. But I used to charge the organizer that ran the tournament, the match captain would pay me $5 per game. And of course, if he didn't pay me for about eight games, it added up to, in those days, was serious money. But in around 1980, I'm not sure of the exact year, I decided to quit a wonderful job that I had. My family was bought and paid for, so to speak. So I actually quit a real good job and became a chess professional. But I had the money attitude long before that, because that gave me incentive, because I had to work for a living, and I generally had menial jobs. And any time I could win some extra money, it made all the difference in the world. And anyways, I became a chess professional, and then I started making money. I was already teaching, writing when I could make money at it, and selling books, and of course, playing. And I used to give exhibitions whenever I could. The most people I've ever played at one time in a simul was about 52, if I remember right.
Wow.
I'd even have to look that up. Mm-hmm. And that isn't too startling anymore. But I gave an occasional exhibition, like at the Burlington Mall, for instance. And then some woman at a mall down the road, I'm trying to think of where it was. It was one of the lesser malls towards the south. She wanted to hold a chess exhibition. So when I showed up there, I was afraid nobody would come. The one at the Burlington Mall was very well advertised. It was part of a men in sports exhibition. They had hockey players there and basketball players. I remember Terry O'Reilly stopping by when I was giving my chess exhibition at the Burlington Mall. He was one of the famous Bruins players. And I says, "Look, there's Terry O'Reilly." I mean, here I was the star, and I was pointing out Terry O'Reilly. Anyways, when I got to this other mall, the woman and I were afraid nobody would come. That's been one of my standard jokes. Suppose you held a chess event and nobody came. So we went to this toy store and bought some chess sets. They were cheap little chess sets, hollow pieces and so on. And we set them up on the tables. And we got little kids to come along. You know, if you stay here for a while and play with the set, you can take it home with you. So that way we got a small crowd. And the most memorable person in that crowd was Jim Rizzitano, who went on to be quite a strong player and a pain in my neck. And he ended up drawing with me. But at the time, his mother brought him to the exhibition. So that ended happily ever after.
So should we be doing more things like that to try to make chess more popular, to draw people in?
Well, nowadays, a lot of the stuff is so commonplace. It's not that flashy anymore, if you know what I'm saying. I actually gave a blindfold exhibition at one of the malls, but just played one game, you know. Mm-hmm. But I remember they actually put a woman's scarf around my eyes, and people would walk by and say, you know, it was quite an attraction. But I can't see that getting, I'm just not sure what should be done nowadays. And particularly with the Globe column is in trouble again. I don't know if you've noticed online, they're trying to get a write-in crusade or campaign. That's what Harold, when they tried to cancel it on Harold Ondas, they got such an influx of complaints, shall we say, very eloquent ones. Larry Eldridge wrote a beauty. He said something about the Globe, if they knock out the chess column, they'd sink to tabloid status. Anyways, they're trying to get Chris Chase. Oh, there's a good thing, too. Mm-hmm. I helped Harold write the column. Harold was only, at his strongest, he was 2,000, but generally speaking, he was a little lower than that, I think. So he enlisted me to write notes to the column. And for a period of time, he used to put annotations by J.C. But then he figured they would confuse me with somebody else, so he started putting my name in. And then when I retired, Pat Wolfe took over. And when he retired, Chris Chase took over. And now Chris Chase has been writing it for 2 or 3 years, and they're threatening to cut it off, too. There was something else in there about players that I've taught.
Yeah, but why do they want to cut it off? It seems as though it would cost almost nothing. I mean,
It's not nothing. Mm-hmm. Oh, they can get syndicated columns like crossword puzzles and and Shelby Lyman's thing. Didn't get those for, I'm not sure now, but like for $5 each, because it's in 100 papers across the country.
I see.
And there's a lot of difference, and I don't know if we should even talk about money now, but, you know, it's a fair piece of change. But one of my most famous pupils was Patrick Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the American Chess Foundation was, they had a, I don't know what you'd call it, they had a program where they would pay strong players to coach promising youngsters. And somehow the parents got involved. I imagine there was tax-deductible monies in there, but I used to get paid by the American Chess Foundation. Mm-hmm. Anyways, I acquired Pat Wolf as a student when he was in his, rated in his 1800s. And he ended up winning the United States Championship a couple times. And, you know,
very impressive.
Yeah, he was really quite strong. I'm trying to think if there's any others. I have a student now that's been coming to me for, this is really ad-libbing, for about 15 years. And after 15 years, at a certain age, you don't learn too much. So I end up entertaining both of us, I think. So the fella still comes after 15 years. I mean, we've become very dear friends, you know.
So what do you try to teach your students? What lessons do you think are most important?
Well, that's a good point, because it mentions something in there. I follow Tarish's dictum, the end game first.
I agree.
You got to do it first. I mean, there's no sense in winning a bunch of pawns if you don't know what to do with them. So you start with the end game. And, of course, basically it's easier because you're dealing with fewer pieces, in a sense. And then you go to the middle game. And if you make it far enough, then you get to the openings. But that's the way Tarish's book is laid out. And that's just the way I believe you should teach. I actually have a syllabus that I used as a lesson plan, and I had problems along the way and so on. And I would give homework.
So in the middle game, do you tell your students to, do you try to teach them how to find the best path, or do you try to...
Well, you talk about things, real basics, like pawn structures, for
mm-hmm.
instance.
Mm-hmm.
That's critical, and that's where people really fall down. They don't use their pawns properly. And was it Philidor said that pawns are the soul of chess or some such thing?
Mm-hmm.
But so pawn structure and as... not only structures generally, but how they relate to the openings you play. That would lead you into openings. And then, of course, there's always tactics. I mean, they either jump out at you. I believe in giving tactics names. And some people use flashcards
mm-hmm.
and things of that nature. But if you talk about the Arabian mate, you should know right off what it is, or the epaulette mate, or of course the smothered mate, and on and on. And if you double attacks, which pieces can double attack? And they'll say pieces can fork. The only pieces that can fork really are the knight and king, because the pieces they are attacking are equidistant. Whereas a bishop might be attacking a piece 5 squares away and another one 2 squares away. So that's not a fork in my book. You got to be more specific. And that's where a lot of teachers vary. Even Bruce Pandolfini varies there. I believe in being very specific when it comes to that kind of stuff. And I drum it in.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, tactics, I think that's something solid that people need to practice. And I like puzzle books. And
you like which?
Puzzle books.
Oh, yeah.
I think they're helpful for students. Now, suppose you have a student and they're playing the Ruy Lopez or something. Do you try to teach them how the middle game, what the proper course of the middle game is as an extension of the opening, or?
No, I'd be more apt to just point out specific plans in a position. Mm-hmm. Like in this position, you're trying to get the F pawn free and, mm-hmm. and you know, advance it and so on. It, just in that sense, I just had another thought that jumped in. Oh, yes. Somewhere along the line, Horowitz, I.A. Horowitz, sold out to the USCF, and that's when they started calling Chess Life and Review at the time.
I remember that.
And they, right now even, there's wonderful problems if you just do the ones in Chess Life. Andy Soltis's problems are a little on the difficult side, I would say, but he has a half a dozen problems there every month. And an easier set of problems, Pandolfini's. If you can't get those, you've got a problem. But they are very basic, and they are also worth doing. And then there's two problems related to the end game, which are rather stiff. I don't want to start bad-mouthing certain individuals.
Okay. So I know you told me that at one point you met Bobby Fischer. What did you think of Bobby Fischer?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's great. Back before the Fischer boom, Bobby was going around the country giving simultaneous exhibitions. Up front, I want to state that I think Bobby Fischer was the greatest player that ever played. Current crop notwithstanding, okay? Because I'm going to badmouth Bobby a bit. But as far as chess goes, he was number one. Okay, so Bobby Fischer was going to give an exhibition in Fitchburg, which is still very active chess club, to say the least. And working up to the exhibition, they were concerned they might not be able to get enough people. So they decided to bring in half a dozen reasonably strong players. I was one. And I guess they had a girl champion, too. I forget who the other people were. But they figured if they couldn't get X number of people, probably 25 or 30 people, that they would have a small exhibition, okay? So I happened to be in the car when they picked up Bobby Fischer. And I'm in the back seat with Bobby Fischer. We're driving to this fella's house. Fred Lawrence, his name was. He not only picked up Bobby at the airport, but he was going to put him up for the period of time. And so I'm in the back seat, and I don't know, maybe they introduced me to Bobby, and Bobby showed a little interest when I was called a chess master. And I said, oh, I'm just a local master. He never talked to me again. So it turns out they didn't need us specialists. They had plenty of people. And one of the most important people was Harold Dundas, who actually beat Bobby. And it's his famous game. He beat him with a two-nights defense, and they actually carried Harold around on their shoulders. But when the exhibition was over, I mean, naturally, Bobby did quite well in it. He's at Fred Lawrence's house, and Fred said, "Bobby, I don't want to put you out, but I'd really love to tell my grandchildren I played a game with you." Bobby said no to this fella that was putting him up and so on. That's sort of a sad story. But again, let's see. Yeah. Go on. That's...
Well, I am curious. I saw a special on HBO once about Bobby, and it just struck me that he didn't seem happy. You know, he had so much success, but he just didn't look like a happy person. What is that? Just the way? Do you think that's true?
Well, you've got to go to his childhood. He didn't really know who his father was. And his mother was an activist. You know, she would do things like chain herself to a fence or something like that until he was able to get what he wanted or something. So his childhood was really sort of fouled up. Mm-hmm. And then I assumed, too, that people would try and take advantage of him. But he would take likings to certain individuals. And that photographer that's getting a lot of play nowadays, apparently they really got along, he and Bobby. Mm-hmm. And Bobby would just gravitate to certain people. And again, during the first match, the match in 1972, we all know how difficult it was to get Bobby up there. And I have to tell you this off key, sugar. I know Harold Dundas went up and he offered to help. I mean, a lot of people were offering to help. You know, they would have done anything to get Bobby to continue the match, mm-hmm. but. You know, he was rejected. But Bobby had a lot of help, and that's one of the reasons that the match did end up coming off. But, you know, I got to leave that.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is stop now. We should talk a lot.
Okay, you want me to